So very welcome to our panel discussion on reward programs and market conduct considerations. And to help me unpack, so I'm going to introduce ourselves first because I was trying to do it the other way around and realized it doesn't work. So please bear with me. There's four little bios to read, just to introduce you to the panel. And then I'll explain why we set up the panel and what we're trying to get from this today. So I'll be your chair. I'm Adele Huisson. I'm associate partner at EY. And I'm a life actuary, though these days I'm also a backyard non-life actuary. I've got over 24 years of experience in the life insurance industry in various fields. I started my career at a mutual, and then I had a 9-year stint in London working for what is now called Willis Stiles Watson. It was the old Tillinghast from way back when, for those of you who are as old as I am. And then I joined EY at the start of 2014. And in my, I've got a few head of actual function roles and static roles, and looking at how you deal with policyholders and deal with them fairly is something that I need to consider on a regular basis. And then just something about me, I love nature, I like to be outside. Despite being an actuary, I do need a bit of thrills to balance out our risk-averse environment. So I do enjoy barreling down mountains on a mountain bike, and the whole family comes along, so it's a family sport for us. Then I've got Rian Virianen. He's the Chief Executive Officer of Discovery Life, and he's worked at Discovery since 1999. He began his tenure working at Discovery Health before joining Discovery Life when it was founded in 2001. He's held the position of Chief Actuary before being appointed as the CEO in 2020, and he represents Discovery on various industry forums. Rihanna's also quite an active person, likes to have a healthy lifestyle and has a wide range of interests, which includes running, mountain biking, boating and water sports. And he's proudly South African and loves to visit local game reserves and spend time with his family on holidays. Then we've got Johan Le Roux. He has been involved in the insurance industry for more than 30 years, starting his career in the corporate actuarial space, but subsequently moved into various executive leadership roles, spanning the domains of product, distribution, advice, and technology. As such, he has been actively involved with the design and management of various product reward and loyalty solutions. He is qualified as a fellow of the Faculty of Actuaries in 1992. He has served on the ASA Council, and is currently very actively involved in the ASA Professionalism Curriculum, where he engages on the subject of subject matter of ethics. And then last but not the least, Natia Nicolai. She's a finance and loyalty professional in the Sanlam FinTech cluster. She's over 30 years of experience in business and actuarial science, with the last 10 years in the wider fields of loyalty and rewards. As head of products, Sanlam Wealth Bonus Reward System, she's proud of its commendation for the best rewards program in the long-term insurance industry. She's passionate about building trust and greater consumer loyalty with solid value propositions that allow South Africans to live a life with confidence. And she says when she isn't navigating the world of fintech, she cooks for her two-meter-tall sons who has brawn and brains, or otherwise she likes to sail the seven seas. So it seems as though we've got an active and adventurous panel here today. And very well equipped and qualified to try and unpack some of the topics we want to cover today. Now, just to set the scene, I'm also part of the Market Conduct Subcommittee, and one of the things we like to do is raise risk and issues and things we see might be coming down the line, and it doesn't necessarily require a guidance or APN, but we do like to get the industry talking. And we also realise there's a fine balance to be struck between regulations and then stifling innovation and giving people opportunity to explore different ways of doing things. So, as I said, part of our job, or what we want to do, is raise awareness on more complex issues. And one of those ones that we're going to discuss today is the topic of loyalty programmes. Now, at the convention, there was a panel, was a debate, as you know, on loyalty programs, and Rian and Natia participated in that debate. But the debate has a very limited format. It's very interesting and entertaining, but we felt there's a few bits that we didn't really unpack. So we thought it'd be good to have a panel discussion, and instead of just delving into the market conduct issues, we are turning things around a bit. So we're going to start off, and Johan, Rian, and Natia is going to have 5 minutes just to present their loyalty and wellness programs, and just to give the what and the why. And the reason we're doing this is, even in the Market Conduct Committee, when we were discussing this panel, the feedback and pushback was, this is not a cookie-cutter situation. You can't take one and just completely compare it with the next one. So you need to understand that kind of complexity. Then we're going to explore some of the issues that the industry should be thinking about and which my panel have been thinking about. I'll then end it off with one of the key issues we have around loyalty programs, specifically the unilateral right of the insurers to change discounts or the loyalty program rules, and whether that potentially could have market conduct considerations further down the line. And then hopefully we'll get really good questions from you to challenge our panel. So with that, I'm going to start with the where's the clicker now? Sorry. Okay, so we've gone through the agenda. So over to you, Rian.
Thanks, Adele. I think I'm also going to stand. It's just easier talking that way. So we've been asked just to share a philosophy around our combined wellness and life product offering. So in discovery, I mean, we like to unpack things with a why, how, and what. So I think everything is centered around our core purpose in discovery of making people healthier and enhancing and protecting their lives. And that really manifests in our life insurance, what we call our shared value product, where we've identified in the World Health Organization data many years back there are four lifestyle behaviors, lifestyle choices that impacts and leads to four chronic conditions, and that, using the World Health Organization data, leads to 60% of death worldwide. Now, it's important to emphasize that these are lifestyle choices, so these are modifiable behaviors. So how we go about it in our shared value life insurance product, we really try and create a virtuous cycle. So if you can incentivize people to change their behavior, to live healthier lifestyles, that will give you a healthier risk pool, so you'll pay out less claims, and you can channel those savings in your risk pool back to your customers, to your policyholders, giving them more rewards in forms of better premiums or better cover, paybacks, cash conversions, those type of benefits, and then within your wellness program as well. And that then creates this virtuous cycle where the more you incentivize people, the healthier they live, the healthier your risk pool, and you end up with a healthier society on the back of it. We've actually found that that's applicable to not only life insurance, but also to other business lines within the discovery stable. So we've spent a lot of time over the years developing data, developing analytical models within the group to try and unpack exactly what is the impact of behavior change as well as selection and modifiable behaviors on health and mortality. We've also separated the impact of aiming at causality, so what's the difference between selection and behavior change. And what we found is, as one would expect, and I think that's common cause by now, but physical behavior in particular has a very material impact on mortality, and it doesn't matter how you cut the data. I mean, I've chosen two graphs in the middle of a slide, just showing that the relative, as physical activity increase, you see significant reductions in mortality, and that's by age. We find the same by geographical locations in the different countries that we've listed there. So it's really a universal theme. So really at the core of a theory is that in certain cases, traditional life insurance models can be ineffective from a risk point of view. So if you think about it in an extreme, the static profile, you underwrite somebody at the start of a contract. These contracts can be extremely long. It can be 30, 40, 50 years. And then if you do not take into account how behavior change can impact your risk and what decisions your policyholders can make over these extremely long contract periods, you end up that you aggregate and really pool controllable risks. And what I've shown on the left-hand side is that you really don't have one mortality curve, but you can unpack that. You can unpack that for people that make healthier choices versus those who don't. And you end up with a very different experience of controllable risks pooled together. And that then could lead to classical selective behavior, where your healthy lives choose to exit your risk pool, or they can get better terms elsewhere, and you end up with a deteriorating risk pool. And as a consequence of controlling or pooling these controllable risks, you really have a cost of cover of a portfolio that's higher than it could have been if you retained your healthy lives. You've got fewer people that end up covered because your healthy lives exit, and your risk pool is worse off. And I think, importantly, you lose the incredible ability that we as life insurers have to have a positive impact on society and make society healthier. I've also decided to illustrate on a specific portfolio how some of these dynamics played out. I think this is one of the questions that really surfaced during the previous debate. And in this portfolio, using actual data, I mean, we have roughly 70% of the value that's generated through behavior change, through better and manifesting in better risk experience, better persistency, that gets plowed back in terms of better benefits back to policyholders, creating this virtuous cycle that I've mentioned before. And then I want to end off by just talking to really one of the questions at heart. How do we change the model to adapt to changes in the environment, to adapt to new technology, to customer behavior? And by its design and by its nature, our wellness program Vitality flexes to take into account changes in the environment. It's founded in our core purpose of making people healthier. So that's really our guiding principle when we set about thinking about how this program should adapt. And it's primarily designed at influencing and incentivizing changes to controllable risks. I think that's a key theme. It's about the risks that policyholders can control. And then the program will adapt with learnings, technology, and changes in the environment over time, as our customers would expect. So the refinements are really focused on this continuous theme of how do we make people healthier, how do we get more incentives around that, and how do we align those incentives to a better understanding of risk. I've also plotted some examples of how the program has evolved. Wearable devices was a pivotal moment in the program where those was introduced, and you know, you can track. It's just so much data that lives on wearable devices. Now you can adopt a program. Through COVID, we've adopted taking vaccinations into account, and really the latest themes are focused on cardiorespiratory fitness and how that impacts mortality and morbidity. I've also listed a checklist for where we do make changes to the program. There's quite a rigorous checklist, taking fairness into account, making sure that really stay true to our core purpose and what we're trying to achieve. And I think importantly, the life product itself also has a lot of guardrails and guarantees and protection against any changes that could manifest in the wellness program. So you need to look at those two together. So that's really a short overview of Discovery Life's product and the Vitality program. I'm going to hand over to Natia.
Thanks. Thanks, Rian. That is really an impressive program. I'd like to take you through the philosophy of the Sanlam's Wealth Bonus Rewards ecosystem. If you own a Sanlam product and have purchased one over the last 3 years, you would be familiar with this. Those of you who are not familiar with this, I hope I can give you a quick overview. So Sanlam has launched a Wealth Bonus ecosystem around 3 years ago, and we have 5 objectives in terms of the Wealth Bonus Rewards ecosystem. We've got currently 7 billion rand of accrued wealth bonuses that we have put aside for our customers for various reasons. First of all, we want to play in the acquisition space, and we want to do this in a fair and aligned with legislative strategy, and we are wanting to take the discussion further than just a financial discussion. We want to also play in the persistency space. We know that people have a lot of risks that they face in society, especially in South Africa, and paying your life insurance premium might not always be top of mind or affordable, so we want to make people think twice before they deviate from their long-term financial plan. We also want to focus on cross-sell. Sanlam is a large insurance group. We currently have 2.5 million wealth bonus customers on our platform. And with these customers, we can try and get bigger share of wallet, meet all their financial needs. We've recently acquired a majority stakeholder in Afrocentric that owns MedScheme. We also own Santam, which is the biggest short-term life insurer in South Africa. And we definitely want to make sure that customers meet all their financial needs with our group, and we use the rewards program for that. We have a large distribution channel. Our intermediaries are really key for us in the South African sense. People trust their advisors, and we want to make sure that they can have a significant discussion with their clients when it comes to a holistic financial play and also the extra lifestyle benefits and extra rewards that are available to the customers. And lastly, financial confidence, which is very important in the South African context. Not everybody plays in the financial services world like we do, and we want to make sure that our customers stick to their financial plan. And with the wealth bonus, they'll think twice before they make changes to that plan. What it is that we do with the wealth bonus ecosystem, we try to meet business as well as client needs, but our business stakeholders are quite diverse, and each of them have different factors, key value drivers that unlocks extra profitability for the business. So Matrix Premier, our fully underwritten life insurance product, our Echo RA product, Glacier as a wealth endowment product. We have a Money Saver credit card. We play in the Sanlam personal loan space. So a lot of different products that are currently participating in this wealth bonus ecosystem. And then, of course, we have the boosters. So for having multiple products, you get a bonus upon a bonus, and that is also hugely powerful and aid a lot of discussions when it comes to the financial needs analysis. So the philosophy really of Sanlam's wealth bonus rewards ecosystem is premised on rewarding clients with cashback instead of premium discount. So in our equation of giving some value back to the customer, you can obviously have the one philosophy, which is a discount on premium, but customers might forget that there is a discount on their premium. It gets used to their debit order going off at the end of the month. Or they can get a significant cashback where they log into their wealth bonus dashboard and they can see how this cashback builds up over time. Sanlam supports and rewards clients who then retain their policy, they pay their premiums or they remain invested with us, and that build up this monetary wealth bonus over time. We therefore believe in underwriting only once so that we can give premium certainty. And we contribute a percentage of every premium. The shareholder contributes a percentage of every premium in our underwritten space towards a wealth bonus account that then accumulates with compound interest. And we then award some of this bonus to the customer over a period at regular intervals, and some of it then vests over time. So we also play in the lifestyle benefit space, and we're very cognizant that behavioral science has a bias towards the shorter term lifestyle rewards, hyperbolic discounting that we also mentioned last year at the convention, which is the fact that the brain values a shorter term, smaller reward more than a longer term, bigger reward. And we do that through a free to member lifestyle benefit program. So if you have a wealth bonus product, you can also have a free lifestyle benefit suite with us. We have Sanlam Reality still, where we have the earn and burn mechanism. So if you do want to have those big rewards when it comes to travel and entertainment, and that also drives behavior, as Rianne has mentioned before. And then we have new rewards concepts that we are working on at the moment. So the rewards business is really focusing on seeing how we can use digital innovation as well to get into the client's household when it comes to a financial discussion, and also become part of their pocket. We then focus on driving that financial well-being, the financial confidence, and at the end of the day, we focus a little bit more on premium certainty and inclusivity. When it comes to the triangle of product and client needs in the loyalty and reward space, it gets quite complex. 76% of South Africans belong to rewards programs. In the affluent, middle to affluent market, 9.8 cards on average in the wallet, rewards program wallet. And in the entry-level market, it is already at 4.8. So everybody's playing the game in South Africa, trying to save a little bit. And I'm not going to ask you how many triangles you see in this big triangle. I know you will be able to give me the right answer. But basically, we know that the top bit is the holy grail in the insurance industry, in any kind of risk assessment and risk management industry. We do know new business, retention, and cross-sell and upsell, very important, but your client needs, if you get your client needs right and your clients are happy with what you are offering them, something for that moment of truth when they had a good workout, the slick redemption process, and also driving regular brand value. Just a few points that we will probably also discuss a bit later, but I think it's very important to think about guarantees versus innovation, and they shouldn't necessarily be mutually exclusive. You can have innovation and guarantees. You can have a reward system that sits on top of guarantees. You can have an earn and a burn game without actually impacting on premiums. So where your customers do want a bit more certainty, as actuaries, we need to understand that life is very uncertain, and that is why we are there to provide longer-term financial security and protection. So in terms of communication and legislation, we know that those are very important to help us to make sure that we have proper policy protection and meet the reasonable policyholders' expectations, but we have to also guard against unnecessary premium fluctuation. We want to have inclusive product design at Sanlam, and our chief actuary there also talks about the head of actuarial increasing the size of the cake for everybody. And in the way that we are looking at things, we do know that in South Africa, not everybody can afford the means to have a very healthy lifestyle. A lot of people struggle in the everyday to make ends meet, to buy the right food, to have the right balance between exercise and actually putting the bread on the table. So we do feel that we need to speak to the needs of everybody and provide some guarantees and longevity in terms of our programs. So I think I covered all the questions here, and I think it's over to Johan. There you go.
Thank you. I'm going to stand, if you don't mind. I'm going to talk about tech, and I'm going to take out a piece of paper. So how's that for modern day? All right. I'm going to be a bit broader, Adele, in the beginning before I actually get to the subject matter. I was asked to talk about the Momentum program, in particular as it touches the protection business, the Myriad business. I just think as a start, I think any market conduct conversation today often is really about how to manage change. I think that's quite real. Industry changes as well as changes in client expectations, and this is not an easy task. I think that's why we're here today. We should also be careful, I think, to some extent in the questions we ask, that defines the problem statement. We're talking about the ethics of loyalty programs today, because often they're based on our historical awareness or understanding of the world, what was. That might not be the reality that is or what is going to be. So I think that's why this is such an interesting conversation. And for the general profession, I think, we navigate the future often based on what we've learned in the past. So that's why I think this is quite an interesting conversation. But industry is changing fast. Rian mentioned we're getting better at diagnosing, understanding risk, how we measure it, how we track it, how we manage it, and all those kind of things play in how we do business. Now, you mentioned loyalty programs in South Africa, massive. I think you said 9.8. The figure used programs on average that the kind of more economically active South Africans, you know, belong to. And this is no different elsewhere in the world. In the US, I think a PayPal.com survey recently also had similar figures, I think just short of 10 loyalty programs. So it's there, it's everywhere. Most of them join to get a better deal, obviously to enjoy the rewards. But it's kind of everywhere, and the financial services industry in South Africa, I think, is no exception. And obviously insurance companies also. The little dogs aren't my picture. It actually comes from the Truth survey that you mentioned, around 9.8. But for me, I think just as a starting point is when you do loyalty programs, I think you need to be quite clear in your strategic objective. And you guys covered it. You know, it's a new business acquisition tool. It's a loyalty program. It's a cross-sell mechanism. It's by design a client engagement tool, because that's what loyalty programs actually do very well. But when you do everything, and many loyalty programs actually do everything at the same time, kind of integrated loyalty wellness programs, it becomes quite a complex thing. And I think that's where the market conduct conversation becomes, I think, a bit more interesting. Now, for Momentum, we actually, for many years, had an integrated loyalty program. It was called Multiply Premier, that ran across all those objectives, and also across different product lines. There were more product lines, product businesses that I show there, actually. It was classic, paid for, incentivized wellness, lifestyle, points, status, you name it. You know, everything was in there. And it was quite successful. But we made a choice about almost 2 years ago to basically exit that approach. I think post-COVID, there were some different dynamics in the industry. We could clearly see that. Client expectations, I think, changed. Maybe the most important reason is the impact of new technology in how we can engage clients and how we can track and measure, you know, certain data points. And we decided to exit. There was also some advice considerations, but I think that's outside of the scope of this conversation. So we basically decided to exit that conversation. Now, in our organization, I would say for two decades at least, there's a debate between the merits of a kind of a product line specific, call it product rewards program, versus an integrated kind of more portfolio level program. And I mean, there's no right or wrong here. They all have merits. And then sometimes this one crowd wins. It's a curial debate, so it's very exciting, by the way. And then sometimes the other crowd actually comes to the table. But more recently, we've decided to adopt a more modular approach, let's say, to product loyalty, if that makes sense. So on the life side, the Myriad side, that is a premium discount mechanism with digital screening tech. That's what I'm going to talk to Adele just now, as per your request. On the health side, it's the classic incentivized wellness programs. On the short-term side and on the savings side, it's kind of more the loyalty bonus conception. Short-term, more on safety, and then on the savings side, more from a loyalty perspective. Now, why did we make this change? I think it was, many reasons, I suppose. I mentioned a few, but I think most important, the impact of new technology. In our opinion, clients are looking for less hassle. I think it's a post-COVID phenomenon, actually. They're a bit more lazy, I think. But not all clients. I'm just making a generic statement. Less effort, maybe. That's maybe a better language. They're looking for more simplicity. And that's why we actually decided to go this particular route. Now, if you ask me about the life returns offering, Adele, is it a loyalty program? That's actually what you can actually ask. Now, it is really a digital game plan. I think that sits at the essence of this concept. It's changing the insurer into basically a digital insurer, creating a digital engagement platform, if that's the right language to speak, for clients and for advisors. So whether it's an underwriting mechanism, we use the mobile screening tech. I see some other product providers have also started to adopt that. You want to fast-track clients to an underwriting process without, you know, the normal traditional medicals. They can do that often, that assessment. They can improve their premiums. It's a real-time discount mechanism into the quote, you know, as the client sitting there. But it's really a upfront mechanism and an ongoing mechanism, you know, at the same time.
It's free, there's no premiums attached to it, so it's really about inclusivity. But I think the important point is we realize that when you do that, you also need to introduce some additional comfort mechanism, you know, in that specific equation. But that's really what the Life Returns offering is about, and obviously there will be more enhancements. I think my key message, and I suppose, you know, you can read that, you know, I think it is so that the world is changing, but it's changing faster than ever before, as I've said. But there's a partnership between product providers and clients that one needs to acknowledge. And how you actually manage that partnership going forward in a responsible way is quite important. And the life industry, I think, needs to figure this out, because that's how you keep the risk pool current, that's how you stay sustainable as a product provider, and obviously, you know, how you manage client expectations. And I think that last bullet probably is my most important one. For me personally, you can have your own opinion. I don't think product providers can build and protect clients' financial dreams, using that language, if they don't stay close to their expectations. And I think loyalty programs can be a great mechanism to do just that. So what you should hear from me, I'm quite positive about loyalty programs, if they actually play that role. And for me personally, I think it's easier to do that if the programs also become easier to understand and easier to drive on behalf of clients. That's it from my side. Thank you.
Thank you. So now to go over to some questions from our panelists. So maybe I'll start with you, Johan. So we're talking today about discounts and how that's not necessarily guaranteed, but let's go more to the basics first. From a risk perspective, is a guaranteed premium a valid expectation for policyholders, do you think, given that...
I think yes. Rian, I think you mentioned guardrails, I think, in your presentation. I think it's we're going to a world of more uncertainty. Just start that. So there's more value on that. Do you think it's fair for a client to expect a whole-of-life guarantee? That's maybe the question you should ask. I'm not there, really. I think that might put... Just might be too much risk, I think, at the end of the day. So proactive money, but the guarantees are important. It's still there. Some companies offer longer guarantees than others, as you know, depending on, I suppose, their business model. But it's more than that. People forget that, I think, a whole-of-life policy in particular, talking risk now, that guaranteed insurability is quite a big thing that a client gets, you know, when they get access to your thing. And I think most product providers I've seen have actually added more benefits to clients, specifically the living benefits side, but, you know, as the definitions evolve. But I still think it's a valid expectation, but I think you need to look at the overall experience as they go into the risk pool over time. I think that's my message.
Yes, now clients definitely have an expectation to rely on the professions, the experts, as well as the capital of the big insurers to protect them when they can't protect themselves. I do think, you know, we live in a dynamic world. There's lots of technology innovation. Health improvements are changing on a daily basis. So we do, as a profession, we do need to take those into account as well and come up with ways in how we can actually review the cover or the premiums over time as well.
So the next question is for you, Rian. So often in the market conduct committee, and we are quite an active committee, I prefer often to what we do there, and we always say if actuaries knew what they know today, they probably would have done things differently 30, 20 years ago, or looked at the terms and conditions a little bit closer to what they promised. So given this rapidly changing world, and things, as Johan also mentioned, the industry and the profession, are we at risk of becoming obsolete if we don't embrace the new technology, the new ideas, what the next generation, even though they're a smaller portion, wants? And is this just actually our way of future-proofing our the insurance industry and going forward, making sure we're not becoming that white elephant?
Yeah, it's a great question, Adele. I mean, my view is that, yes, we should embrace technology. I mean, our customers probably expect us to embrace technology. It's a changing world. And as we learn more about risk through technological advances, data enhancements or advances, artificial intelligence, and also medical enhancements, it makes sense to apply that to our understanding of risk, our modeling of risk, and into our product. Yeah, to me, it's analogous to think of what have we done in the past. I mean, if you're scared about new technology or understanding of risk, our understanding of risk has evolved in the past. I mean, we've, as a profession, introduced things like smoker status and rating on hazardous pursuits and occupations and those type of things based on our understanding. So I think it's no different in a way to embracing technology. I think the scary thing is it's moving at a much more rapid pace. I mean, if we just think recently, one of the big things that I think the world is grappling with is what is the impact of GLP-1 drugs, for example, on obesity, and that's got potentially massive implications on longevity and future mortality. So I think we definitely need to adapt, is my view.
Great. So actually, I was going to mix things around a bit. So Nasia, one interesting point that was raised when we talked about what to discuss today was around generations. And the thing that I was wondering when we were discussed this whether was whether there's requirement or worry about discounts being changed because the loyalty program changed, or there's some uncertainty whether this is not maybe a generational issue. Because, and I'll give you a chance to expand, you mentioned that young people seem to be less concerned with it, and where, because they've grew up in a very different environment that we grew up in, where the older generation sort of seem to like the stuff they used to know. So what is your experience in this market around the different generations and what they actually expect and what they want?
Yes, there's definitely a big difference in terms of your expectations from your insurance company. When you're younger, you might not have a mortgage, you might not have dependents. So, you know, if you do take out some cover, maybe, earnings cover, disability cover, etc., you would like to be rated according to what you see you can do with your health and how you can improve that over time. But as life comes home to you and you become older, you have that family, you start showing symptoms of something that you have inherited, different factors in your life that you couldn't control, you really value that certainty. And that is where we have a big responsibility. If you look at the actuarial notes, the guidance around policyholders' reasonable expectations over the whole duration of the policy, it is important to get that balance right between making sure that you have flexibility in your products, to make sure that you speak to the needs of everybody, those who are also changing their risk behavior. There might be a smoker who stops smoking, etc., that you play into the innovation that is available out there, but that you also over the long term make sure that you're inclusive, and that you increase the insurability in the South African context.
So just to follow up on that one as well, so one thing I was thinking about when you mentioned that while we were sort of spitballing ideas was young people like little, this is like discounts now because they might not have as big as a salary and they want to spend money in other places, and then so they some of them are quite happy to take the discounts now and then potentially pay a little bit more later on. And that might think about pension funds, because in pension funds, initially, when you just join, you don't mind if you invested in equities and more risky stuff, but as you get older, you want more certainty and you go into more boring investments. So how potentially, if you've thought about it, how do we balance that then between the generations, where young people are quite happy today to say, great, give me the discount, I'll take it, but in about 15 years' time, when they've got a kid or someone is ill, they might have a very different view?
Yeah. It's an interesting question. I mean, we have to be innovative, think out of the box in terms of our product design as well. I mean, we have the Bright Rock example, you know, where your life needs changes as your life stage change, and therefore your cover should adopt to that, and the premium should adopt to that. The other concept is the wealth bonus system, where you use cashbacks instead of premium changes. to reward behavioral change over time. So you can definitely do that as well. But we have to also take into account that if you drive things too far, you might, in terms of, you know, being very specific on the risk that you are measuring over time, you might then become overly focused on getting the right risk premium out, and some people might become uninsurable, your risk pools might shrink as well. Yeah,
I think the point is no, I think clients have got different, I don't think there's a right or wrong answer. I mean, cashbacks actually work as a retention mechanism. I think that's what you're trying to achieve. You also get very fit 65 or 70-year-olds. Now, I might not look it. I am reasonably fit, by the way. But I think the key risk, which both are actually trying to manage, maybe, Rian, you're better positioned to comment on this, is if let's call it your healthier clients, jump out of your risk pool in some way or another. I mean, you guys want to go further and actually make them healthier. Then that's where the problem starts to come in. So you also need to stay attractive to the fitter, let's call it older people, then, if that's your language to use, to try and manage that, you know, going forward. And I think in the health industry, with community rating, you need youngsters to come into the medical scheme, you know, to help the overall health, you know, of the medical scheme. But there's no right or wrong here. I think it was must work for you. We went the discount route because the clients could do other things with the money now if they want to, but it must be within reason, and that's maybe your point.
Yeah.
There must be some limits around that, and I think that's how you manage it. But, I mean, all know fitness is quite an important rating factor also nowadays, so that's how you... But it's client's choice at the end of the day, I think, what they want to do, but then you need to be quite transparent, whether it's a wealth bonus route, like you've just said, or something else around that. That's my view.
Yes.
So you actually touched something that I wanted to explore as well. So, and this is not just loyalty programs in general. It seems to be the insurance industry with all the tech and all information and data analytics and all those kind of things. So as insurance industry, we used to manage risk, young people, sort of cross-subsidized, the older people, the healthy, the unhealthy, etc. And with all the information we have and how sometimes you can tailor someone's premium or discount, do you think there's a risk that we might be swinging the pendulum too much to one side and looking at individual risk management? And how do you manage that you don't end up sort of, as you say, exactly for that point, you can really tailor the premiums, but then the unhealthy people will be uninsurable and the healthy people, you know, may not actually think they need insurance because they're healthy. So how do we manage that, like this whole new world of technology and data at our fingertips and balance that? Any suggestions or thoughts?
No, there is definitely a balance to be found there. If you work in a business that is a for-profit business, then obviously you're going to look for those business opportunities. And as a profession, we need to guide, as Rian was saying, you know, put the guardrails up, make sure there's proper communication and there's some legislative assessment around the new products that you put on the table. We do know that... even though we might know a lot about medical outcomes, if only your very super healthy lives are getting the cover, the pools might be still relatively small in South Africa. I think the other day I read about the percentage of South Africans that actually have proper life insurance, not funeral insurance, but proper life insurance, it's, I think, somewhere between 20 and 30%. And also in Africa, we know that insurance is not widespread in Africa for risk cover. So therefore, we do need to understand what our market is that we are after, you know, what kind of market segment we want to bring into the fold and how do we best serve that market need.
So, Rian, a question for you then, and we've touched on it in the presentations and in the discussions so far, is around loyalty programs And they can either be very simple or very complex. And then there's this whole explaining discounts. And I know even from my experience, I've got friends who are very intelligent, but they're not in the financial industry. And they sometimes struggle to understand what they're actually taking out. So how do you manage this whole policyholder communication and the risk around that of explaining not just insurance product, but now you've overlaid a loyalty or wellness program on top of that as well?
No, it's important to make sure that the communication is clear, that I think there's a big role for advice. I mean, all our products are advice-led, making sure that the advisor and the customer understand what they're buying. But I think one of the unique things that a rewards program or a wellness program in our case provides you is with regular touch points to your customer. I mean, it's very digital, so you've got engagement with your customers, you've got regular touch points, and you can show how you interact and nudge customers along this wellness journey and interactively show how this can benefit you financially as well as how it benefits your health. So I think it's clear communication is critical, keeping things as simple as you can, but at regular touch points is important. I think it also, in fact, it's got benefits on the life insurance side as well, where it really changes the dynamic from a life insurance policy being this static document that's lying dead, excuse the pun, lying dead in a drawer, to something that you engage with and can get real value out of. So I think keeping things simple and regular communication is key. Okay.
So the last question before I get to the question is for you, maybe on first. So we know, and just not in insurance, we've seen it in social media, we've seen it with AI, and also in insurance, and particularly South Africa has always been a very vibrant, forward-thinking insurance industry at the forefront of new ideas. Is there a risk with these kind of things, or do you think there's a risk that regulation is sort of lagging and not catching up with how quickly the insurance industry is changing? I mean, I know we as a profession has a role to play this as well, but do you think there's a big risk, or...
Look, I'm by design not negative about regulations. Can I just say that? They normally have a positive intent from a public interest perspective. I think regulations, the ethics of regulations are a little bit rearview mirror, if you think about it. You know, something went wrong or we got concerned about something, and then we act, you know, on that. Any rule system, I think, is a little bit that. So I think that will depend on how the collective industry now, insurance, financial service, and South Africa at large, you know, engage clients on this. I think clients don't like surprises. That's maybe the most important point. Rian mentioned about communication. If you take the surprise factor out of the system, I think you actually get it right, and because then there's authenticity in the positioning and the communication. How you regulate, I don't know, because there's so many different levels. You know, you also spoke about all the objectives that a loyalty program is trying to achieve, but you know, I look at my bank as an example. I think they got their numbers wrong, by the way. I don't know if there's actually at the back, but I mean, I get a lot back from my bank, so I'm happy. But I can see it sometimes gets repriced, you know what I mean, and it gets reduced. But I'm not surprised by it, but I'm still okay. But I think how you manage that will be key, because otherwise regulations will come, because that's when regulations show up, you know.
I think we have quite a solid set in the PPRs, policyholder protection rules. I can remember I was at a different company when the PPRs came out that sort of spoke to the inducement clause in the Long-Term Insurance Act, and it was quite a big day for the big green company, because they then realized they can go ahead with their own rewards program. And it's really around the PPRs say that they define a loyalty benefits. So it wasn't, you know, you don't speak about loyalty benefits when it comes to long-term insurance. So loyalty benefits are defined. But it also states then that if you offer this loyalty benefit in whatever form it is, that you need to make sure that the client understands
that there is such a thing linked to this product. And if the cost is more than 10% of the premium, you need to disclose the cost. So it is what you're saying, you know, communication is key, making sure that the customer understands what they're buying, and that we don't, you know, do the mis-selling. And so the regulator definitely supports these kind of incentives. I think they see the benefit of it, whether it is to drive behavior in the health space or the persistency space, as long as we make sure that the unscrupulous advisors or some unscrupulous sellers don't abuse the benefits.
Yeah, I think maybe to add to that, we've got a very principles-based framework as well, and I think that adds protection to it, so you can apply those same principles to various products. And, I mean, if you really put your customer first and you make that a win-win through your, be it a rewards or loyalty or wellness program, I think that's the safest place to be of all, because then your customer want to engage and want to be with you. And from a principles point, there's a lot of safety in that.
So just to finish off then, so hopefully the audience today have realized that loyalty programs are complex and different and varied. You can't put them all in little buckets. And hopefully we've made you think about some of the things we need to think about when we look at our new generation of policyholders. But then, this answer, the question was sort of answered now already indirectly, but I'll go there still. So I think the one thing the Market Conduct Committee has been grappling with is there's obviously we need to future-proof, we need to be active, people love their loyalty programs, it definitely has a benefit. But the worry is always, are we setting ourselves up for the next insurance like scandal in a few years' time like there's been before, like with profits and all sorts of other things. So we can all see the benefits. There has been some criticism that there's the PPRs and the regulations when you actually set the core premium of the product, and then you might have some sort of discount or benefit on top of that, and there's more limited, if no regulation. So the core premium, that's fine. We've got all guidance in the ticklers, but when it comes to the sort of how you set these programs up, how they could change, there's less regulation around that. So is there the potential, or does it open up policyholders to be slightly disadvantaged when insurers are looking for, or the shareholders are more looking for profits, and you then sort of adjust the scheme to change it into your benefit? Or is it that really that, but as you say, the relationship that you build with your clients, where the industry can, if we get it right, self-regulate? So just maybe your thoughts on that as a closing thought. Should we start with you, Nadia, and then...
No, go first. Obviously, our new approach is closer to the to the core PPR kind of environment than previously, but I can talk to both worlds. I think the fundamental issue is the business objective and the client outcomes and the sustainability of that going forward, what you're trying to achieve. If that is sound, I think you don't have a problem. You know what I'm trying to say? And I think product providers will probably also learn as they go along and improve, you know, that matching that business objective with the client outcomes and getting better at it. I think that for me is a real asset test. And if that is in place, whether it's now in or out, I actually think, you know, it's okay. That's my view. But, yeah, I don't know, maybe you can...
Yeah. If the client understands upfront what the potential impact on his premium or her premium might be, should certain things not go according to plan in future, then, you know, the risk is on the policyholder. We do need to make sure that especially the younger clients understand that when you enter into a long-term contract, it is much more cost-efficient to try and stick to the same long-term contract, because we know health changes over time. I do think, though, that over-regulation is not necessarily going to be the answer. I do think that the rewards programs in South Africa are mature enough, and enough people are participating in it, thanks to our colleague and his company here, that we keep each other in
and check. And people, you know, also move between different companies. The advisors know, you know, what can and cannot be done. If you have the principles behind the rewards programs, you can make it work both for the industry and also both for the profession to have that sustainability at the end of the day.
Yeah, and I think to add to that, as long as you stick to really what is the purpose of what you're trying to do, and in our case, it's making people healthier. I mean, that's your win-win. So it's not that's really the phase behind it. And if you really get it right, you end up with, like we said, a healthier risk pool, but also a healthier society, lowering the burden of disease. And it's really hard to fault that. It's not a profit driver. It's a risk reduction factor.
Thank you very much. So, thank you for the time you've made. We'll now open the floor for questions. I'm sure there must be a few questions here.
Am I audible? Okay, thank you. Good afternoon, and thank you for great discussion. As I was listening, loyalty benefits, to be honest, they are wonderful from a policyholder perspective and also on the other side. Especially on the benefits that I get as a policyholder, but also the wonderful as a benefit from an insurance perspective. However, I just want to hear some of your thoughts in terms of how do you manage in terms of the cost of offering this loyalty rewards programs compared to the benefits. How do you make sure that you practically make sure that the cost does not outweigh the benefits of offering this loyalty programs?
Yeah, I guess that depends on the richness and the breadth of the complexity of the loyalty program. Something like digital tech has got a cost, but you price that into the overall business cost. I know, Rian, maybe you can add incentivized wellness. Probably it's a different engine, but clients also contribute to that. I think, and that helps with the. I don't know the wealth bonus at well, but I think it depends whether it's a free program or a paid-for program. That's the first point. Mm-hmm. And then and from there, you know, what the member of that program then gets versus what you will actually experience in the product space. I think for me, the line of sight between the product benefit or discount or wealth bonus versus what you earn, I think that's important to get those dynamics right in your pricing. That's where the actuaries in wellness programs actually have got quite an interesting task, I think, to do that well. But complex client engagement programs can be expensive. That's my opinion. But clients then choose to join that also. I don't know, Rian, whether you can add. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I think it's a great question in terms of balancing mm-hmm. that. So you've got various sources of income, be it the membership fee, be it discounts from a big pool negotiating with providers. And then in our case, also what you unlock through wellness, through that, the savings in the risk pool. And you need to pool all of those together in terms of understanding what's available in terms of benefits. So, I mean, that is part of a science. And, you know, that's also where benefits and engagement are nudged on a frequent basis to keep everything in balance.
Yeah, maybe I can just add to that. There's definitely a need for more actuaries in the reward space because it can get quite complex. Definitely what Rian was saying is, you know, if you negotiate these big wholesale discounts with retailers and providers out there, you could spread that discount so that your net sum is around the price that you are paying as a big corporate, and that will then incentivize people to go for that carrot, which is the one way of loyalty. The other one is the nudges, the gamification, that also has different models. Obviously, the spin and win, and you have little financial models around that. And then ultimately, your product houses might want to subsidize this because you are proving that you can shift the behavior, and so the shareholder will then put some value on the table, and that's the shared value model that Rian was talking about.
Any other questions before we take one last online question, because I'm sure you all want a coffee or a break quickly? So there's one question.
How's it, guys? Thanks for unpacking it as well as you have. Just linking back to the first discussion this morning around the poverty premium, the barrier to entry of loyalty schemes that we've described now is quite high. And the benefits that are coming out of loyalty schemes are very valuable for those who we were talking about this morning. What's your thoughts around how you allow for, let's call it cross-subsidization, that it gives more access to the kind of benefits that we are giving to a more affluent market in the context of the loyalty schemes where we're all fighting for a slightly smaller pie of consumers versus the ones who can benefit more intently from the kind of protection that the insurance industry can give?
Yeah, I'm happy to jump in. So I think, Andrew, you're spot on that. I mean, in terms of certainly what I've described is aimed at the affluent protection market. I mean, we do have a lower price point. So, I mean, if you talk about the Vitality program, you've got the full suite of Vitality, and we do offer life insurance with what we call Vitality Active, which is kind of one tier down, and that's been very popular. Exactly the same dynamics with the aim of making people healthier. But aimed at a slightly lower price point. And I think the challenge is how do you extend this really into other market segments. But it still means that as long as you can lower the burden of disease for society, some of these lifestyle choices are also correlated more in your wealthy space. I think the correlation is strong. But that is the challenge. How do we cascade that down into all market segments?
Thank you. Great presentations. My question is really around causation versus correlation. Are we really changing behavior, or are we simply selecting for better lives, which tend to be wealthier, more educated, you know? So it's around, like, you know, causal analysis and are we really sure that we're really changing the behavior in the way that we think we are? Thank you.
So I'm happy to take that. I mean, that's a whole separate discussion that can last days and if not weeks. We've got a whole data team that's actively engaged on that. I think the short answer is we've spent years in the data and developing new techniques to answer exactly that question, and we have made some material breakthroughs in the Vitality data, grouping worldwide data to test through longitudinal studies and adjusting for confounders in the data, what is the impact in different demographics of selection versus behavior change? And I mean, that is a good question, and there's a lot of application there. So the short answer is yes, we are making very good progress in separating that.
We have done a similar thing at Sanlam as well. We've done a causality study as opposed to a correlation study, where we actually looked at 8 independent data sets over a number of years and then did a statistical modeling, a general linear regression modeling, where we took into account all the different factors to see, you know, that does the loyalty indicator actually change over time? And, you know, does that impact on the size of the financial portfolios or not? And that definitely showed a positive trend. It showed us that there was quite a big level of causality. And just to test the outcomes of these models, we threw it to a data robot, and they used a bit of machine learning as well, and the data robot told us exactly the same thing, that it was a big determining variable.
I think we run out of time. I didn't get to the online questions, but some of the questions that was asked on the floor overlapped. So I think it would just be sort of a repeat. So thank you very much, Natia, Johan, and Rian, for making the time. I know you're all very busy, and hopefully this has been a thought-provoking session for everyone. Thank you.
Thanks, Adele.
Thanks, Adele. Thanks a lot.